Mr. Toucher.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court and Counsel. My name is Bert Sacek. I represent the defendants, Anchor Mortgage and John Munson. And we have three main issues on appeal. This is a case involving the False Claims Act, and Anchor Mortgage and, to a degree, John Munson were found liable for monies that they owe for making incorrect statements. The first issue is we contend that the standard of culpability needed for the False Claims Act was not met. There's probably very little dispute that false statements were submitted, and there might be even less dispute about that whether there's negligence or not involved in that. But in order to impose liability under the False Claims Act, a mental state of knowingly is required, and knowingly is defined as reckless disregard or deliberate indifference. And there were things, I think, that anybody looking at the record would say, maybe this should have been caught. Maybe things that were happening. And I'm not talking about the false statements made by Anchor Mortgage, by the way. I'm talking specifically about the incorrect statements made by John Munson. The false statements made by Anchor Mortgage were made by an employee who was convicted of criminal activity for falsifying records belonging to the borrowers. And, you know, those statements, the knowledge he had is imputed to Anchor Mortgage, and it's a given that those were reckless, deliberate, intentional. But the statements that Mr. Munson was found to have knowingly, incorrectly made were certifications.
Counsel, I'm not sure what your argument is. This is an adverse decision after a bench trial, and our standard of review is whether the district court has made clearly erroneous findings of fact. You seem to be arguing this case as if we were the fact finder. We're not. We have to decide whether District Judge Cannelli made clearly erroneous findings. What makes you think his findings were clearly erroneous?
I think that the factors that he looked at to determine whether Mr. Munson should be found to have the culpability necessary were insufficient to get to that requisite level. I think that there were things that were wrong.
No idea what that means.
I think what I'm saying, Judge, is that in order for the judge to have determined that Mr. Munson should be found liable under the False Claims Act,
We're not talking about should be found liable. We're talking about a finding of fact about a person's state of mind. And as the famous phrase goes, the state of a man's mind is as much a fact as the state of his digestion. So there's a finding of fact that Munson actually knew these statements were false.
Right.
So why is that clearly erroneous?
Because I don't think that there was anything in the record that showed that he clearly knew that those statements that he was making were false. What the facts showed was everybody that he was connected with, everybody that testified for the government, thought that Mr. Munson was the kind of person that would have done things legally. There was a legal way for these payments to have been made, and there were two different legal ways for these payments to have been made. One was for there to have been a controlled business arrangement, or the other one was for the company to whom these payments, which were not great, they were between, I think, $205 and $500, was actually performing services. And what the facts showed was that Mr. Munson had taken a course on how to do the controlled business arrangement. He had instructed his attorney to prepare it, the necessary documentation. He had given the paperwork in order for that to happen. The two witnesses that testified against Mr. Munson said that they believed that the paperwork had been tendered in order for the other company to sign off on it. And, in fact, Mr. Munson believed the paperwork had been given to Mr. Bassano, one of the witnesses. And in the end of the day, it didn't happen, though.
This sounds like the argument you made to the district judge, and he didn't buy it.
Agreed. It is the argument that we made to him. I'm hoping that
it's the usual phrase about this is just wasted on an appellate court. You've got a legal argument. Perhaps you might want to get to it.
Sure. In regard to the calculation of damages, the judge cited United States of America versus Bornstein in order to say we're going to triple the damages that the government incurred. But
okay, here's your problem. The United States says that the argument you make about this was not made in the district court until the second post-trial motion. Until then, you never asked the district judge to deduct before trebling rather than trebling and then deducting. Now, is that accurate or not?
I don't think it is. I think we cited in our reply brief where the issue came up at the end of the trial. And we attempted to get the judge, there was some effort, a request to even have post-trial briefs in order to submit, you know, further argument on the issue. But the issue, I think, undeniably, I contend, came up, and the judge ruled against us on that one.
Okay. Where was the first time that you expressly asked the district court to deduct the recoveries before trebling?
I don't see in my notes that I have indicated exactly where that came up.
Indeed, your reply brief doesn't either. Right? That's the question, right? You've got a potential legal issue. The United States says it was forfeited by not being raised earlier. The way to respond to that is to show exactly where and how it was raised. And a reply at oral argument is too late.
And let me say two things then. One, if we are talking about a measure of damages, I don't think that it's necessarily fair to say that somehow an argument that the judge should follow the existing Supreme Court law somehow no longer is binding just because we contend that it didn't happen. If there's a standard that which the court is supposed to apply in determining what the damages are, then why wouldn't that issue be something that says everybody's supposed to
only
do the counting?
If it's raised by the parties. The parties shape what issues they wish to raise. It is not the judge's obligation to go and find law not drawn to his attention by the parties. This is a pretty fundamental rule of litigation counsel.
But if you look at the case, though, that the judge himself cited, which, you know, that's the case that we're talking about, United States versus Bornstein, the issue is expressed expressly in that case. If you look at note 13, which he's following this case, and yet he ended up not following the case is what essentially happened. I can't tell.
Did you make an argument in your closing argument to the judge that the value of the property should be deducted?
We did.
At the time of
I apologize that it's not cited in the brief, but we did make the closing argument that the government's calculation of damages should not encompass something that the case that they cited, and I agree, I apologize it's not there, but we specifically noted that that's not what the case law said.
Well, did you do it in that kind of oblique way, or did you specifically say to the judge that your argument was that the value of the property should be deducted before trebling?
I think that we said it exactly as you're saying it. I mean, with, you know, obvious variations, but it was not done in an oblique way at all. It had been an issue that we were talking about directly. It was something that was on everybody's mind at the time, and that's why, in fact, I think the judge, when he ruled the way that he did, specifically noted by citing the reference to Bornstein that you're not supposed to calculate any of the monies that were received by the government. That's how he got to that point. It just so happens that the phrase that he took out referred only to the portions of money that were received by way of settlement because of the obvious reasons that Bornstein says. But I think that the fact that he was bringing it up, it was in response to something that we were arguing, because otherwise there really wouldn't have been a reason to say, here's why I think we calculate the damages that way. It came up. It was in closing argument. I apologize that we did not somehow manage to point out where it happened. But in the end, we asked for that argument. We proposed it. It's a logical argument. It's one that the Supreme Court agrees with, I believe, because they mentioned actual damages in terms of what's supposed to be at the time of Bornstein doubled. Today it's tripling. And then they looked at the fact that when they gave note 13, they specifically referenced the fact that the government's damages are equal to the difference between the market value of what the government got. Here there's no dispute that the government received.
Did you argue it in just that way? I mean, Bornstein is a case about collateral source payments.
It is, yes.
And so did you draw the distinction between what the proper measure of base damages were here before trebling as against, you know, deducting a collateral source payment? Or did you not draw that distinction?
We didn't know specifically that the judge was going to point to Bornstein because we thought it was so inapt. So I don't know that we made the distinction as bright line as saying it's not quite the, you know, this thing. But we were pointing out the specific argument that you cannot treble the damages without giving regard to what it is that the government received, because the statute says you're supposed to treble the actual damages. I see my time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Pruitt.
May it please the court, counsel. Eric Pruitt on behalf of the United States. With respect to this issue,
Zotrick, you belong at counsel table. This case is still going on.
I'll begin with the issue of the forfeiture of the damages argument. This issue was raised in a very, I think the word used was oblique and vague way by the defendant. It's record 265 at 337 in their closing. But I think if you look at that, it's very oblique, it's very vague with the point they're making, but more importantly, what they said was, quote, we haven't been able to find any case law on this, and then actually tried to distinguish Bornstein without citing it by name. So while they raised the general issue, the fairness, and kind of in an oblique way raised the issue of trebling, they did not present the argument that they later made in that second motion to alter amend the judgment, which was a very, much more articulated argument trying to invoke Bornstein in their favor rather than saying, as they did in their closing, we haven't been able to find any case law and Bornstein is distinguishable. So I do not think that that argument was presented to the district court in a way that would have preserved it for appeal, and I think the judge should not abuse his discretion in refusing
to... Did the defense in closing argument rely perhaps on the language of the statute? Because the language of the statute says that damages are supposed to be trebled. And damages means net loss. It doesn't mean gross loss.
Well, Your Honor, we believe that the Supreme Court addressed that.
I'm not interested in what you believe. I'm asking you a factual question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Did the defense rely on the language of the statute?
I do not believe they did in their argument, Your Honor, no. As we point out in our brief, we believe that this issue has also been forfeited on appeal as well because counsel failed to attach a copy of the transcript of the September 15th hearing and make it part of the record on appeal, where Judge Kennelly did rule on the actual motion where they brought this argument up for the first time. So we believe it's been forfeited twice.
I'm now completely lost. How can either something that happened in trial or any motion filed in the district court not be part of the record?
Your Honor,
it's filed in court, it's part of the record.
Sorry, perhaps I misspoke. The Rule 59 motion they filed is part of the record. The transcript of the hearing at which Judge Kennelly ruled on that motion was not made part of the record.
It would certainly be part of the record if it's been actually transcribed.
I do not believe it was asked to be transcribed.
Oh, well, if it was never transcribed, then you lack a transcript, you lack a transcript. But if there is a transcript, it's part of the record.
Yes, Your Honor, of course. I believe it's the obligation of the party if they want to raise this issue on appeal to order the transcript.
The party wants to make an argument based on something that happened in open court has got to order a transcript. That much I understand.
And that's the argument I'm intending to make, Your Honor.
Was there a minute order or something else memorializing what happened?
There was a minute order. All it said, Your Honor, was that the motion is denied in part and granted in part. It was granted in part with respect to a minor issue with respect to calculation that did not affect this issue. Unfortunately, it said nothing more than that. With respect to the merits of the damages argument, we believe that both the text of the False Claims Act and the Supreme Court's holding in Bornstein support the government's approach to calculation of damages here. The text says the United States is entitled to three times the amount of damages which the government sustains because of the acts of the defendant. The Supreme Court in Bornstein specifically noted that it does not say net damages or uncompensated damages.
Damages means net. Courts award damages in civil cases, and damages means, in a standard contract case, what you paid less what you got.
Right?
That's
Honor,
just the normal means by which courts compute damages. What do you need to say in a statute?
If this was a contract case that involved the sale of goods, and it was analogous to Bornstein in that way, I think that they might have a point. If we had contracted to buy a radio, the radio wasn't worth quite what we thought it was going to be, then the difference in market value would be an appropriate measure of damages.
Absolutely.
Absolutely,
you
Your Honor.
You say treble what was paid minus the value of the radio.
But
so why do you do it here?
Because this is a false certification case, Your Honor, and we believe that what is distinguishable in that
way. The radio case is also a false certification case, right? The government orders a radio that meets standards A, B, and C. Turns out there's a false certification. The radio meets standards A and B, but it has value, right? So what's the approach? Do you treble what was paid and then deduct the value of the radio, or do you deduct the value of the radio and treble the difference? The latter, I should think, because that's what damages are.
We agree that that's how the Supreme Court ruled in that case, and that was appropriate. Here, the United States did not contract to buy a house. The United States, based on the certifications of the defendant, provided mortgage insurance. And it did so in exchange for the defendant providing a mortgage to a lender who might not otherwise qualify. But for those false certifications, it would not have offered that mortgage insurance. So the damage caused by the defendant in this instance, we believe, is the money paid out when a claim was submitted on the mortgage insurance, and that the monies recouped through sale of the home is analogous to the money the United States was able to recoup in Bornstein by going after the prime contractor.
Bornstein was a collateral source payment case. The recoupment of the value of the house here goes to the proper measure of damages, not whether damages should be reduced by receipt of payment from a collateral source. That's a different kind of a case. Well, and that's what Bornstein had to do with. The court said damages are measured in this way, you know, value of the property as represented versus value of the property as delivered.
Mm-hmm.
Treble that and then deduct collateral source payments. But that's not what we've got here. We don't have a collateral source payment issue.
Well, Your Honor, I guess we would characterize it as that, respectfully, Your Honor, that there was no guarantee that the United States would be able to recover anything by taking title to these homes. We didn't want to take title to these homes. It wasn't, you know, this was simply a remedial measure that was in place. And that,
well, you know, I understand that, but you step into the shoes of the lender when you pay the mm-hmm. insurance payments out, right? You're subrogated to the recovery from the sale of the home.
No, the United States takes title to the home and then undertakes its own efforts to
it
carry the house and sell it.
It operates the same way as a subrogation would. But that, so once you pay the insurance payments, then you take title of the house and can recoup the value of the house. And in an ordinary civil case, as the Chief Judge has pointed out, you'd deduct those recoveries in the measure of damages, of base damages.
You know, and that might be the case in other contexts. I don't believe it is appropriate here because I don't believe it would be consistent with the purpose of the treble damages provision, which is meant to be punitive.
Meant to inflate the base measure of damages.
Well, we don't believe it does, Your Honor. I believe the damage that was caused, again, is that initial amount that is paid out pursuant to the mortgage insurance.
In your view, why doesn't the statute say treble the amount paid?
I can't speak to that, Your Honor.
Well, one reason why it might not say that is because damages has an actual meaning in law. Right? Your approach doesn't look, right? You haven't given us other examples of the use of the word damages to mean gross rather than net. Right, you can write down in a statute fundamentally two different things. You could write down payment, that's the gross measure, or you could write down damages, that's the net measure. You're asking us to read the standard word used for net measure as a reference to gross. And that's, well, unusual. So you'd expect some support for it other than we like it or it helps us win here or
Your
something
Honor,
like that.
Yes, we believe that Bornstein's a support for that, where they know.
Bornstein says the collateral source rule does not reduce damages under the Tort Claims Act. That's the holding of Bornstein. It doesn't hold anything more than that.
Well, Your Honor, part of that holding, also the Supreme Court said that the word damages in the False Claims Act does not mean net damages or uncompensated damages.
No, footnote 13 says it does mean net. You can't just ignore footnote 13. Bornstein is about the collateral source rule. That's what it says. That's what it talks about.
Your Honor, I read footnote 10 of that opinion to actually state the opposite. But I believe that it would be inconsistent with the purpose of the troubling provision to interpret it in this way. If you interpret it that way, I believe it would create the wrong incentives for people engaging in this kind of business if they can submit false certifications to the government, with the knowledge and just kind of sit back with the knowledge, well, the United States will do what it can to recoup it. And if the United States had recouped all of value here through sale of the homes, there would have been nothing to trouble at all, and there would have been no damages whatsoever. And I think that would undermine the purpose of the False Claims Act. I see my time is about to expire if there are no further questions.
So let me just make sure I'm understanding you. So you're saying if the government had recovered 100% of the loan amount on each property through subsequent sales, there would still be treble damages?
There would be nothing to treble under this theory because the net would be zero.
Right.
And then there's nothing to treble, so there would be no damages.
So the government would get its $2,000 or $2,500 per claim.
And penalties, right, and that would be
the penalty amount, but there wouldn't be anything to treble. What's wrong with that?
We believe what's wrong with that, Your Honor, is that would not serve the purpose of the FCA, which is to disincentivize fraud.
The government thinks that $2,000 plus the possibility of criminal punishment is not enough to deter people from committing harmless frauds, because by definition what we're talking about here is harmless frauds. Gee.
Well, I don't believe that mortgage fraud is a harmless fraud, Your Honor, but that is our position. Thank you. If there are no further questions.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.